Ross Baker, let's read the 2012 election leaves and tell us what you make of the fallout since the election.
Well, I think that the the president, I think, won a decisive victory over Mitt Romney. And I think, to the great surprise of many people, the Democrats not only held on to the majority in the Senate, but strengthened their majority, and with the addition of two independents, gives them a majority of 55. It's still not big enough to overcome the filibuster, which requires 60 votes to shut down, but it's still a strong performance. The Democrats in the House fared less well. There was really very little hope, for a variety of reasons, that they would actually recapture the majority that they lost in 2010. But they did pick up more than half a dozen seats, and so it makes things a little bit closer. But it wasn't so resounding a victory that the Republicans, for example, became humbled and began to sort of look for ways to conciliate with President Obama. I think the Republicans have indicated that they intend to sort of fight the old fights that they fought in the 112th Congress, and with perhaps a little bit more humility.
You know, Ross Baker, you are, of course, perhaps, I'm going to say it, the most important political scientist in America on this issue. And therefore, I respectfully say to you, I see some differences after the election. For example, I see some sense that they may have to give way on revenue. In other words, new taxes in a way that I didn't think they'd ever come to. And in terms of the respect for some of the minorities in the United States, soon to become majorities, like the Hispanic population, I certainly see some changes, don't you?
Sure I do. I didn't mean to suggest that everything after the election was exactly what it was before. I think in terms of the really important problems confronting the president in his second term and the new Congress, unquestionably, it's this incredible complex of fiscal issues surrounding what's come to be known as the fiscal cliff, the name bestowed on it by Ben Bernanke. And right now, that is, as the time that we speak, which is, of course, the latter part of November, that they're still in the kind of semantic stage of negotiations. The whole definition of the term revenue has now become a subject of negotiation. How you define revenue, which is clearly a major component of deficit reduction, whether it is altering the tax code or whether it is taxing the wealthiest Americans more heavily, that hasn't been decided yet. They're still playing with the definitions. And I think there's a long way to go, even though the first meeting between the president and the Speaker of the House and the minority leader went in a reasonably civil way. There's just a long way to go, and I think that, as I say, the Republicans are humbled, but certainly not vanquished.
Well, I've seen some polling that I found very interesting that suggests that the American people are holding the Republicans more responsible for the intransigence and the fiscal cliff than the Democrats. How does that affect the negotiating posture of both parties?
Well, I think that politicians are always mindful of the polls. And I think the Republicans are torn between, taking a kind of bloody but unbowed position as opposed to one which signals a greater degree of cooperation with the president. They're having to play it in a very, very subtle kind of way. You mentioned before, for example, the whole question of how poorly they did with minority groups, particularly Latinos. Clearly they want to do something, but, given the fact that they are so heavily invested in things like border security and that the constituencies that they do have, the solid constituencies that they enjoy among Southerners, among white men, and so on, as much as they would love to get those Latino votes, but at the same time they are very much constrained by constituencies that already support them. And it's an interesting question about whether or not you trade off an existing set of supporters for the potential of getting another set of supporters. And my sense is that almost anything the Republicans do now, in terms of, let's say, immigration policy, is not going to be anything more than cosmetic.
Well, you know, I'm fascinated, Ross, by this because I read the Times in the middle of the night. I get up and I read it online and then I got us back to sleep. And one of the articles showed that Jeb Bush is now looking like a favorite. Now, of course, you know that he is married to, I believe, a Latina. And all of a sudden, the unthinkable is happening. That was supposed to be what was weighing him down. Now seems to be helping him.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, personally, I'm disgusted with the idea of dynastic politics in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's...
You can sign right under my name. Go ahead.
I mean, even, you know, taking into account the Adams family and the Harrisons and so on, I think perhaps, you know, two Bushes are enough. I think it gives him a kind of entree with that constituency that certainly no other prominent Republican has. But I just wonder whether the kind of residual resentment against his brother isn't going to be a problem for him. George W. Bush is not a beloved figure in the Republican Party.
As demonstrated by his absence from the National Convention compared to Bill Clinton, for example.
Absolutely. He was a non-person. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, he's seen as, in a sense, someone flying under false colors, and particularly having to do with the prescription drug attachment to Medicare, which many conservatives really feel was unwarranted and, of course, wasn't paid for. And it constituted certainly a major expansion in the scope of government, which was odious to people on the right.
Fascinating. So the Senate, I want to ask you about this, has new blood coming in 2012. We all read back in the day U.S. senators and their world and the rest of it, and Hubert Humphreys saying, you know, you should shut up for a long time before you get up to make your maiden speech. Do those rules still apply?
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Alan. They don't apply in the same way. Certainly the idea that a senator's maiden speech in the Senate has to be on something regarding his own state, the idea that somehow you must apprentice yourself to a senior senator in order to begin the climb up the ladder of influence in the Senate, I mean, those things are in the past. But in terms of the influence of brand new senators on the kinds of issues such as the fiscal cliff, such as, for example, what to do about the filibuster, you know, these are questions that are largely being dealt with at the leadership level. And in fact, it's one of the complaints that the junior senators have, the people like Michael Bennett from Colorado and Mark Warner from Virginia. They're people who are quite unhappy about the lack of influence that they have. In fact, there was a rumor going around that Mark Warner was actually going to leave the Senate and run for governor of Virginia again. And he's decided against that. But that's one of the problems, and that is that influence still does come with seniority. And as much as, for example, someone like Elizabeth Warren becomes a real Senate celebrity, you know, nonetheless, she's going to be relatively low in seniority on the banking committee, the committee that she wants to get on. And, you know, that's definitely going to limit, you know, her influence, even though she's respected for her intellect and for her qualities as a campaigner.
Well, now, we only have a minute, but Hillary Clinton, when she became a senator, certainly worked well with others and kept relatively quiet, didn't she?
Yes, she did. And that was a decision on her part. No one forced her to do it. And she understood, and I think quite astutely, that getting on the right committee was really important. And the committee she chose was Armed Services. And she chose it for a very specific reason. And that is that whereas traditionally the committee that the presidential hopefuls want to get on was Foreign Relations, you know, sort of to... Mm. You know, give you the kind of credibility that you would need to run for president. Now it's more likely to be Armed Service, and I think as a woman also, I think she felt that getting on this macho committee was really a really good way to sort of say that, yes, I too can be a commander-in-chief.
And Ross Baker is professor of political science at Rutgers University, received a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, research associate at the Brookings Institute, and has served on the staffs of 5 U.S. senators and members of the House. He is considered to be perhaps the most important political scientist in America in this area. And thank you so much, Ross, for being with us. When we come back the next time, I got some other questions for you.
It's always a pleasure, Alan.